The Renaissance began with great confidence in man's autonomous reason. And from that high point of optimism came, in a sense, to a position of despair regarding the possibility of objectivity, the possibility of rationality, and the possibility of morality. The Renaissance and the Enlightenment ended with a failure to find any reliable method for reasoning, ended in disagreements over the instrument of reasoning itself, what is the nature of man's mind, and ended in unpleasant social consequences as well. Hume had to conclude, we have no reason to be optimistic. Reason is finally useless. There is no basis for our ethics or our science that we can find in reason. And so he was a skeptic. Kant said Hume awakened him from his dogmatic slumbers. As a reminder, the dates for Immanuel Kant's life were 1724 to 1804. And so almost perfectly, Kant, you see, is the one who puts not only, from the standpoint of the development of thought, a nice bookend to the Enlightenment, but he also, his life ends at the beginning of the 19th century. Kant is, in a sense, the crossroads of rationalism and empiricism. He doesn't believe that we can know things apart from the manifold of the world out there, encountering some kind of sensation. And so he agrees with the empiricist. But he also believes with the rationalist that you can't make sense of experience apart from using your mind and your reasoning. Kant wished to save science and to make room for faith. How could he save science from David Hume's skepticism? Well, David Hume had said the human mind has no identity. What are you as a human being? A bundle of sensations. You have one feeling, another feeling, one sensation, one observation, and they all just kind of flicker along like that, but there's no unity to it. And so the mind has no unity, and the world has no unity. There's no causation. There's just event, 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 event. And so there's no place for science, no place for causality. Immanuel Kant said the difficulty is that Hume and others have assumed that the human mind is passive. It's like the human mind standing here as an observer, and the world is, whirling by out there, and the mind is observing this world passively. As a matter of fact, according to Kant, the mind is an active function, an active instrument, so that it doesn't just sit there and receive passively sensations from the world. It is working over those sensations and organizing them so that they are interpretable, that they are intelligible. And one of the categories that the active mind of man imposes upon the raw sensations coming from out there is the category of causality. We don't know what the world is like out there. We don't know things in themselves. All right, I'm putting another dichotomy on the board here. Things in themselves, we don't know what they really are like out there. We only know them as they appear to us. So Kant is willing to be agnostic about ultimate reality. We don't know what the world is like ultimately. Thales said it's all water. Kant says you can't know. You don't know things in themselves. You can only know things as they appear. And the way things appear is largely dominated by the organizational function of the mind itself. And so since the mind has this category of causality that is imposed upon the sensations coming in, we have saved science. You know, sports fans, you got to catch this because this is crucial. The science that's saved is not objective science, is it? It's subjective science. It's things as they appear have got to be scientifically understood, but we don't know about things in themselves. Things in themselves, you're going to hear this language over the next few lectures, so I want to make sure you know what I'm getting at. What Kant called the noumena. Things as they appear are the phenomena. Now, since we don't know the noumena, there's room for faith. There's that, if you will, mystical domain where man just has to say, reason can't take me there. And so Kant developed a kind of Christianity where faith is non-rational. Rationality deals with things as they appear. The mind makes things rational. But there is something, there is a realm beyond the mind. It's just you can't say anything about it. You know that it exists, but you can't tell us anything about it. And this is, of course, the seedbed of modern theology. Modern theology says, you know, you can have this Bible and all these things down here in the realm of phenomena, but that can't tell you anything about a God that is metaphysical, that's in the realm of things as they really are. We can only know God as He appears to us. We can't know God as He really is. Well, the temptation is to go into a lot more about Kant in particular. I wanted you to hear this much so that you would have some sense of the development of philosophy from the earliest days to the skepticism of Hume and Kant's attempt to overcome it. What were Plato and Aristotle trying to do way back when? They're trying to save objectivity, rationality, and morality. Now, I believe that in the Word of God, in the worldview of Christianity, we have the philosophy that's perfectly adequate to do that. But as men through the Middle Ages start dichotomizing faith and reason and secularizing reason, by the time we get to the Renaissance, we see again these problems arising where, now how is there room for value in the realm of nature? If nature is mechanistic, how can man have any uniqueness? How can man be free? How can there be moral values? Eventually, the attempts of the humanistic philosophers, the autonomous philosophers, to answer these problems brings us right back to ancient philosophy's difficulty of how can there be objectivity? How can there be rationality? How can there be morality? Kant answers the skepticism of Hume by giving up objectivity. He saves rationality, but it's now a subjective rationality rather than a rationality that tells us about the world itself or things in themselves as they really are. So Kant's rationality puts the emphasis upon the subject of knowing, the person who knows, rather than upon the objectivity of what he knows, rather than on the rationality of the world that's out there. It's just a rationality that's imposed by the subject in here. Now, I'm purposely slanting my summaries of Kant here, because I want you to tell me now, if you've been listening, for all of their differences in temperament and approach, what did Rousseau and Kant have in common? What kind of orientation or emphasis did they share, both Rousseau and Kant? Think about that for a minute. All right, so what did they have in common? What was the emphasis that you find in both Kant and Rousseau? Anybody? Yes?
Was it the individual and the subjective experience?
Very good. That's right. Focus upon the subjective, in particular the individual's subjective approach. Now, the reason we say individual is because both these men emphasized the discreteness of reality. There are things which are separate from one another, which are individual, if you will. And Rousseau said that the individual should get in touch with his feelings, a more subjective, empathetic, intuitive approach to reality. Kant did not take the empathetic, intuitive approach. He wanted to be rational. But in the end, Kant's rationality is not objective rationality. It's the rationality that comes from the subject of knower, a knowing, the knower himself. So that's very good. I appreciate that answer. By the time we come to the 19th century, then you see the orientation is going to be toward the individual and his subjective experience. Having said that, let me rehearse for you what might be called the assumptions of the Enlightenment. These are the assumptions of that optimism at the beginning of the Enlightenment that said man can gain certainty through the use of his reasoning. The optimistic outlook of the Enlightenment that said man can find certainty through the use of his reasoning. I'm going to give you five assumptions of that optimism. At the beginning of the Enlightenment, the time of the Renaissance, moving into the Enlightenment, most philosophers took it for granted, one, that there is objective truth that is rationally discernible. There is objective truth that is rationally discernible. On the board here, and just so we can keep track of this, The Enlightenment represents the optimistic view that you can gain certainty through reason. And the first assumption of that optimism is that there is objective truth and it's rationally discernible. Secondly, that things are separate and distinct from one another. The world in which we live is made up of people and things, and they are individual. They are distinct and separate. Third, man's mind is capable of understanding the truth. There is objective truth, and man's mind, this is the third assumption, can understand it. Man's mind is capable of understanding the truth. Fourth, at the beginning of the Enlightenment, and as you see this worked out in the debate between continental rationalism and British empiricism, the Enlightenment assumption is that science begins with propositions whose truth is immediately recognizable. Science begins with propositions whose truth is immediately recognizable. Now that takes two forms, of course. The continental rationalists say that science begins with truths which are self-evident, clear and distinct ideas. And so it begins with those things which are immediately recognizable as true in and of themselves. The British empiricists also say science begins with propositions whose truth is immediately recognizable, but here the truth is not recognizable inherently in the proposition. It's recognizable because science begins with our sensations or our observations. You can't deny your observation, okay? Red, round, now, when I have an apple in front of me, can't be denied, okay? science begins with those kinds of things, red round now, or that's an apple on the table, if you will. So they both, the rationalist and the empiricist, say that science has got to have foundations that are immediately recognizable as true. And then fifthly, the Enlightenment assumption is that man's will can act in accordance with reason. Man's will can act in accordance with reason. A somewhat optimistic view of human nature, if you will. Man is basically good, and if you educate him and show him the right way, he'll do what is right. He can act in accordance with reason. It's the old just say no campaign, you know? Here's the answer to drugs. Educate people. Just say no. On that, by the way, how's it going? The campaign to stop drug use working with the idea that men just have their reason reformed and informed that they'll stop using drugs? Pretty sad, isn't it? But at the beginning of the Enlightenment, this was the optimistic outlook. Man's reason is adequate. Man has a good character. If he uses his reason, he can solve his problems. There is truth out there to be found. Man's mind is capable of finding it. And science just needs to begin with truths that are immediately recognizable as true. Okay, so this little dance that I'm rehearsing for you here, the Enlightenment has this optimistic view that certainty is available through reason. Now we come to Hume and Kant, and reason is chastened. We can no longer be as optimistic as the Enlightenment started out thinking. With Hume, we end up in skepticism. Don't we? How's man's reason doing now? Well, it doesn't look very good. Man's mind is a loose bundle of sensations. The world has no connections out there. It's just a meaningless sequence of events. And so with David Hume, man's reason is severely chastened. I mean, how much more chastening can you take? He ends up in skepticism. You can't know anything for sure. And notice this, Hume is skeptical regarding the object and the subject of knowledge. The object and the subject of knowledge. And again, for our new students, let's just make sure we understand what I'm saying. The object of knowledge is what you think about when you know something. Okay? If I know that salt dissolves in water, then the object of knowledge is salt and water, and particularly their relationship of salt dissolving in water, what I know about. The subject of knowledge is the knower himself. I'm the subject that knows the object. Okay? And what I've just said is that with Hume, skepticism overwhelms reason regarding both the object and the subject of knowledge. I can't know myself rationally. I'm just a bundle of sensations. And I can't know the object of knowledge, the world out there, because it's just a meaningless sequence of events. As we said a moment ago, Kant shifts the emphasis, as did Rousseau as well, to an orientation regarding the subject of knowing. For Kant, his Copernican revolution, by which he's going to save science and make room for faith, comes because he realizes that man's subjective mind is active in the knowing process. The mind of man is working over these sensations and making them intelligible. And the great price that is paid for saving science is that subjective orientation. because Kant's philosophy leaves us with metaphysical agnosticism.
And I'm going to put back on the board now the terms that I introduced earlier. Remember, for Kant, there's noumena, things in themselves, or if you will, the ultimately real, the way the world really is, metaphysics, and then there's phenomena, things as they appear to us. And Kant saved the rationality of the phenomena by saying man's subjective mind imposes causality and other categories like that for intelligibility on our sensations. And this leads then to now I can begin to introduce the subject of this course, 19th and 20th century philosophy. If you're with me up to this point, we can say that the 19th century begins to offer different strategies for restoring certainty. The Enlightenment had said certainty can be gained through reason. By the time we get to Hume and Kant, reason is sorely chastened, virtually destroyed by Hume. And when Kant restores it or tries to salvage reason to save science, he saves it only in terms of the phenomena, the subjective, active orientation of the mind is what saves rationality in science for Kant. And so now we're going to look at different strategies for trying to restore certainty after this period of chastening, if you will. From looking at the board, does this help you visualize the flow, then, of philosophical thought? When we get to the 19th century, the 1800s, there are three primary strategies that we're going to see. And I'm going to talk about them more in depth and detail, obviously. But right now, I just want you to have an idea of where we are going so it makes sense to you. The first strategy is to revive reason in a more sophisticated form. I'm going to abbreviate on the board here. But the whole thing says to revive reason in a more sophisticated form. By reviving reason, or refurbishing it, you have kind of a new approach to reason, okay? So I'll just put it on the board
by putting new in parentheses. Revive reason, but it's a new reason, a more sophisticated form of reasoning. And this is what you find in Hegel. Hegel says, we can restore the certainty that's been lost through the skepticism of Hume and the subjectivism of Kant. We can restore certainty if we just refurbish what we call reasoning. If we have a new approach to logic and to thinking that doesn't have the naivete of the Enlightenment. Okay, up here on the board I said the Enlightenment represents certainty gained through reason. Well, but this reason of the Enlightenment is kind of puerile, it's childish. Hegel says we need to have a more sophisticated, a more determinative, a more precise understanding of how reason operates. And if we do, then we can gain certainty about metaphysics. We can know the nature of reality. So the first strategy, the Hegelian, says revive reason. But it's not the old reason, it's the new reason. The second strategy is to restrict reason to its proper functions. restrict reason to its proper functions. These philosophers don't want to throw away reason. They simply want to say reason is not appropriate for metaphysics. Reason can't tell us about ultimate reality. And so here we have the materialistic and positivistic side of the 19th century. There were plenty who wanted to see science advance. In fact, you could really call this scientism, if you will. Ultimate faith in man's scientific ability. And reason is perfectly all right if it's addressing medical advances, industrial advances. It can understand the natural world and control the natural world. It's just don't try to use reason to talk about the nature of man or his soul or an afterlife or God or ethical values or what have you. Just keep reason very secular, if you will. Now, the board's not big enough to keep all of my things, but you may remember way back when I said the seeds of the Renaissance were sown at the end of the Middle Ages in this dichotomy between faith and reason. But you understand what I'm getting at, if I can put it a little less precisely. The positivists of the 19th century, those who were materialistic and oriented toward science or scientism, basically said, reason's perfectly all right if you keep it with respect to nature. Just don't try to make reason tell you what reality is, what the nature of man is, whether there's God, and so forth. Restrict its use, and it's perfectly okay. And then the third strategy for restoring certainty was to disregard reason in favor of alternative access to metaphysical truth. Disregard reason in favor of an alternative. That is to say, there are other approaches that can put us in touch with the ultimate truth about the world and man. Metaphysical truth or metaphysical reality can be reached apart from reason. And the reason that I have for reminding you about Rousseau is so that you would understand this option. Rousseau said what? It isn't important that we mediate our experience through reasoning. What's important is that we savor our experience directly. The romantic approach of direct intuition. And there are going to be a variety of approaches in the 19th century that say to reason that's been slain at the end of the Enlightenment, good riddance, who needs it? That's just a way of distorting our experience anyway. So let's get back to direct experience, you know, and have the more empathetic, feeling, intuitive approach to this world. Go ahead.
Where's the church?
All over the playing field, unfortunately. The church doesn't have, usually, defenders of the faith that are keeping up with the philosophers so that they can be answering them. And often enough, the church is caught in what can be called a Babylonian captivity to the philosophers. When it does get around to interacting with the world, the church often takes these philosophers and then tries to give us a version of Christianity that fits in with them. So you have many Hegelian or idealistic versions of Christianity. Or you'll have people that try to go along with the scientism of, the Darwinian revolution. You have those people who say, well, okay, the doctrine of creation is being maintained by saying God did it through an evolutionary process. And you have people who say that Christianity is not a matter of reason. These alternative accesses to metaphysical reality, that's what religion's all about. And so you have romanticized versions of Christianity, the religion of feeling. We don't need a creed. We don't need a dogma. We're all in tune with God. And this is a shameful thing. I'm glad you asked the question. But in the answer, I can't give you something that's going to make you happy. Shamefully, the church is either ignoring these things, not aware of them, and therefore not adequately encountering the culture of the day, or it's coming captive to them and
interpreting Christianity.